It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Today was the day, people. The Federal Reserve has changed its mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. On the theory that it is good to understand why things that are in the news are happening, let us begin today with a brief disquisition from Fed Chair Jay Powell about its announcement today that sooner rather than later, perhaps a lot sooner, the Fed is going to start cutting back on some of the help it has been giving this economy the past year and a half. Specifically, what has come to be called tapering, the Fed gradually slowing down its bond purchases.
The test for beginning our taper is that we've achieved substantial further progress toward our goals of inflation and maximum employment.
That's what Powell and the Fed have been saying all year, substantial further progress, and we are getting there.
And for inflation, we appear to have achieved more than significant progress. Substantial further progress. So that part of the test is achieved, in my view, and in the view of many others.
I mean, we've talked about inflation, right? You and I, no need to review.
So the question is really on the maximum employment test.
Yes, Mr. Powell, yes it is.
I guess my own view would be that the substantial further progress test for employment is all but met.
Others on the Federal Open Market Committee differ in degree, not really in substance, which is to say the taper is close.
And so once we've met those two tests, once the committee decides that they've met, and that could come as soon as the next meeting.
Next meeting, by the way, is the first week of November. But look, everything Powell said today is great and important to understand because what the Fed does affects basically everything in this economy. But as we like to say around here, you got to make me give a darn. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore got that assignment today.
March of 2020, lockdowns came to the U.S., and so did an overwhelming sense of anxiety.
Markets were not functioning very well.
Randy Krosner is a former Fed governor and an econ professor at University of Chicago.
There was so much tumult that the Fed felt it needed to make sure that the pandemic health crisis didn't turn into a financial crisis.
So the Fed started basically printing money and using it to buy bonds. Ken Kuttner is a professor of economics at Williams College.
$80 billion a month in treasury bonds and $40 billion a month in mortgage-backed securities.
$120 billion a month, every month, to this day, basically artificially propping up the price of bonds. But of all things to prop up, why bonds?
The intention was to push down long-term interest rates.
Driving up bond prices has the effect of lowering their interest rates, and in turn, lowering lots of other connected interest rates in the economy. Interest rates you might just care about.
Lower the borrowing costs of households on their mortgages, for example, and lower the costs of corporations to borrow by issuing their debt.
This whole operation has kept a lot of people's mortgage rates down. It's been keeping some companies afloat. It's been a fire hose on the financial fire of this pandemic. And soon, it's going to start turning off. Eric Stein is chief investment officer for fixed income at Eaton Vance.
People should care because, you know, there are effects on the economy if it's done incorrectly.
The Fed doesn't want to abandon a fragile economy too soon. And the last time the Fed tapered off stimulus, markets were caught off guard and had a meltdown, and they called it a taper tantrum. But the Fed has to shut off the faucet eventually, or it could risk serious inflation. So it's been talking about it a lot.
They don't want to spook the market, and they're not entirely sure about the pace of the economic recovery. And I think that's what's leading to this back and forth and talking about tapering.
Turn off the fire hose too soon and the fire's not out. Turn it off too late and you flood the whole neighborhood. That is why we care about tapering. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Washington is nowhere on economic policy. The Fed is talking about tapering, and yet, up stocks went. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Democrats in the House passed a bill last night that'll keep the government open until early December while they work out the details for the rest of the fiscal year. It also suspends the debt ceiling. So, you know, the economy doesn't collapse. Republicans, by the way, are likely no votes on that. But even away from the politics, the debt limit and a full-year spending bill are two pretty serious items. But the bill also includes money to help Afghan evacuees, $6.3 billion, and almost $29 billion for disaster aid. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams took a look at why that funding for natural disasters always seems to get wrapped up in this kind of drama.
The federal government does budget for disaster funding every year, but
here's the thing. For a really long time, we've been regularly overrunning the disaster relief fund.
Laura Blessing is a senior fellow at Georgetown's Government Affairs Institute.
There's just so many more disasters that get declared and that money is needed for.
Now, in the Schoolhouse Rock version of Congress, when there's a need for extra disaster aid, there'd be a bill that would make its way through Capitol Hill to appropriate the funds in Washington speak. But, says Peter Van Doren, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, things don't really work that way anymore.
And now it's just lately Congress, because it's so divided and in gridlock, finds it convenient to do lots of things through these large must-pass budget bills of one sort or another.
Must-pass legislation like this government funding bill. They're supposed to be done at the end of the fiscal year, which happens to come up around the peak of hurricane and wildfire season.
The nature of nature and then the nature of the budgetary calendar coincide in a bad way.
Because members of Congress want to prove to constituents that, in an emergency, they can get federal help to them quickly. And when they don't, says Daniel Tellis, a senior research associate at the Urban Institute,
the states and local governments are unable to fully put their plans in place and act. And that, therefore, slows down their ability to then distribute funds,
putting even more pressure on members of Congress to pass legislation they might otherwise balk at. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As of yesterday afternoon, should you be in need of another indicator of the supply chain kludginess that endures in this economy, there were 69 container ships waiting to be unloaded at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And as frustrating as it is for consumers to deal with not getting what we want when we want it, for entrepreneurs trying to launch new products and grow their companies, those supply chain tangles are high stakes indeed. Lindsay McCormick is one of those entrepreneurs. She used to travel a lot for her job as a TV producer, and she went looking for a sustainable alternative to those tiny travel-sized toothpaste tubes.
And I couldn't find anything on the market, so I ended up making our toothpaste tablets. I took online chemistry classes, talked to dentists, dental hygienists, and then started pressing them out in my living room on this machine that I have behind me, actually. And that's how it all started.
Lindsay's company, Bite, has gone from making plastic-free toothpaste tablets in her living room and selling them on Etsy to shipping millions of dollars worth of oral care products every year. Till now, Bite's pretty much just made stuff for your teeth. But today is launch day for something new, which I asked Lindsay to show me on our Zoom.
So this is our 100% plastic-free deodorant with compostable refills.
Okay.
So this is our deodorant is an aluminum case, and it is made in China. And we also have a 100% paper refill that's made of cardboard that's also made in China. This is our first time working with custom componentry, which meant, you know, steel dies had to be made at a manufacturer in China to get these things made. So it's just been this kind of enormous project for our super small team at probably one of the craziest times to be doing something like this.
I'm sure. So we should say, though, this is, I mean, hold it up again. It's about the size of a pack of cigarettes, right? It's aluminum and shiny, and it says Bite on it. I don't know if you're a Marketplace listener, and if not, why not? But if you were listening the other day, I told everybody that aluminum had hit a 10-year high.
Yeah.
And there's the sharp
intake. I know that viscerally.
Right. And there's the sharp intake of breath. So what are you doing as you look at the supply crunch and you're saying, oh, my goodness, what is that doing to your pricing power?
You know, it's been a challenge. We are not passing on a lot of our, you know, increased costs to our customer. A lot of these issues we are planning for as temporary. So things like our air freight is crazy expensive right now. Yeah. We had a quote for $30,000 to get our components to us. And typically it would be somewhere between like 11 to 13, right? So that's something where it's like, wow, like this is something we need to get this. It's also, you know, we're in mid-September right now. We're also going into holiday. So there's a lot of reasons that the prices are like this and we'll just take the hit for a small amount of time.
Okay, small amount of time. So let me now interject a guy by the name of Jay Powell into this conversation. He is, of course, the chairman of the Fed, and he's on your side, or maybe you're on his, I don't know, that inflation is going to be a small amount of time. Mm. You are betting a product launch. You're betting your pricing power. What if you're wrong?
It's a really good question. And it's so out of our control, right?
Yeah.
So I would say the things that we're doing to kind of help absorb some of this is that, you know, yes, we had to air freight the first shipment to make for launch. But we do see kind of the clear sky coming, you know, after the holidays when we can get our stuff on boats and we can just kind of freight it over for an easier price that way.
Fair enough. What about other raw materials that are going into this thing besides the aluminum? Are you having problems there?
Yeah.
So we
found out that our main ingredient is it's basically like an oil, like a wax.
Yep.
And it has tripled in price since we started this. And so luckily it had actually tripled and now it had gone down to only double the price, you know, like at this point that feels like a deal. And you know, so for us, it was, we have really great relationships with our manufacturers and our vendors. And so they're helping us take some of the price hit on that, and then hope we'll kind of be long-term partners.
So you're banking on the long haul, right?
Yeah. But it's something too, you know, it's not like we're in a bad position, right? We're just not as in a good position as it would have been if we weren't getting $30,000 air freight bills, right? So it's those kind of things that you look at. But I think that's, you know, what is it? Well, there's like a saying, like rough seas make great sailors or something.
Right,
and so this
that.
Is our rough sea. And yeah, this is the, fair. This is how we learn how to sail.
I imagine somewhere deep in the Bite corporate secret files, you have the next product launch sort of mapped out. Has this experience changed you at all?
I will definitely make sure that we are not launching near the holidays again. You know, that's a really intense thing, but also it's like to expect the unexpected. So, you know, we're a small team. We've told ourselves every time we've had a launch that we're going to get way ahead of it next time. But the fact is that we do have to play the best hand we're dealt. And I think, you know, if we make it through this one, we can make it through all the other launches we have coming down the pipe.
Lindsay McCormick, the founder and CEO of Bite and their new deodorant coming soon, I imagine, to a retailer near you. Lindsay, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
transition to renewable forms of energy.
Essential, but expensive. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials advanced 338 points today, 1%, 34,258. The NASDAQ added 150 points, 1%, finished at 14,896. The S&P 500 up 41, 0.9%, 43.95 there. FedEx sank 9%. The company yesterday cut its financial outlook for the year due in part to rising costs associated with a shortage of workers. A factory acquisition to tell you about now, a confections plant owned by a Mr. Charlie Bucket, who took control of the industrial asset after a much-heralded golden ticket competition, is being snapped up by Netflix, which is also buying all the other assets of the Roald Dahl story company, which includes the likes of Fantastic Mr. Fox and The Big Friendly Giant. Netflix plans to make animated and live-action films based on Dahl's characters. Netflix added 3% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Oh, hey, look, Brexit is still a thing even after all these years. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, couldn't get President Biden on board with a standalone UK-US trade deal when the two met at the White House yesterday. Add that then to the list of somehow unforeseen consequences Brexit was going to bring to the British economy. One of the biggies was that Brexit would devastate London's financial center, the city as it's known. And the warnings made sense at the time. Leaving the EU would have meant London-based banks and financial firms would lose their unfettered access to the common market. Trading in euro-denominated shares and securities has been limited to European exchanges. But all is often not as it seems, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Half dead at the height of the pandemic, the British capital today is bustling back into life.
Mind the gap. Stand clear of the doors, please.
The London Underground has just recorded its busiest morning since the start of the first lockdown more than 18 months ago. And half the staff who work in Britain's most successful industry are back in the office, making money.
25:40.
But the dealers and traders, bankers and brokers in London's financial district have been making money throughout the pandemic, many of them while working from home, showing resilience not just in the face of COVID-19, but in the teeth of Brexit as well.
The UK has actually grown its exports of financial services to the European Union, confounding totally the predictions of people who were in favour of remaining in the EU.
Businessman and former member of the European Parliament for the Brexit Party, John Longworth. He says the 1.4% increase in banking, insurance and other financial exports to the EU in the first quarter, in spite of the barriers erected by Brussels, shows that the city is unstoppable.
London will continue to prosper and will actually go from strength to strength.
It's no surprise that the city's unofficial anthem is the Scipio March from Handel's opera about one of ancient Rome's most fearsome generals. The city is bullish, to say the least. More than two-thirds of city firms in a recent poll were confident that London's dominance will remain unassailable. Barnabas Reynolds, a partner in the international law firm Sherman & Sterling.
The city continues to be a top two global financial centre, with the most competitive pricing and offerings of financial products and services. The liquidity and the pricing here is second to none.
But Brussels hasn't done yet with assailing the city. The Eurocrats now have their eyes on the square miles derivatives clearing market, a vast $770 trillion business. Jack Neil Hall of the lobbying organisation The City UK.
London doesn't just dominate this market in Europe. It is the main global hub for clearing. For example, more dollars are cleared in London than they are in New York.
The derivatives clearing houses act as middlemen between the buyers and sellers of things like swaps, options and futures. They ensure that trades are settled even if one of the parties goes bust.
The bigger your clearing industry is, the lower the costs and the better risk is distributed across the system. It's like insurance. The more people involved, the safer it is.
Which is why most of it happens in one place, London. But Brussels wants to hive off all the euro derivatives clearing, about a quarter of the London market, and locate it within the EU. Bad for the city, says Neil Hall, but even worse for the bloc.
So for European businesses, it means greater costs, fewer and less tailored and flexible products, and a greater underlying risk to EU business.
Nevertheless, the EU continues to press the banks to shift their euro clearing to the continent. Economist and veteran city watcher Andrew Hilton says the city's unbowed, but has been a little bit bloodied by Brexit.
Amsterdam has picked up some equities business. France has picked up some hedge fund business. Germany has picked up a bit of banking business. But there's no single financial centre that yet threatens London.
They could all, however, continue to nibble away at the city's lion's share of European financial business. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Amid all the geopolitics at the UN General Assembly this week, there have been some items of global-scale economic note. In his speech yesterday, President Biden said he wants the United States to double how much it's giving developing countries every year to help mitigate the effects of climate change. Back in 2009, the United States and some other developed economies promised that by 2020, they would come up with $100 billion a year, every year, to help developing countries reduce carbon emissions and adapt to climate change. So Marketplace's Samantha Fields decided to find out how that was going.
There's a lot that needs to happen in every country if the world is going to cut greenhouse gas emissions and adapt to a climate that's already changing. Lauren Stewart works on climate change policy at Oxfam, and she says depending on the country, that might mean
providing financial resources to help a rural farmer adapt their crops to droughts, or halting deforestation, or supporting the development of renewable energy.
But all of that is too expensive for many countries. Take India, for example, where millions of people still don't have reliable access to energy and electricity.
Currently, the cheapest way for India to provide that energy would be to burn coal. And what we need India to do instead is to transition to renewable forms of energy. It's very difficult for them to do that on their own.
Brandon Wu at the international NGO ActionAid says that is where climate financing needs to come in.
To provide a country like India the means to make that transition to a cleaner economy without leaving massive numbers of people behind.
Developing countries also need money for climate adaptation and resilience, he says, and for rebuilding after natural disasters. So in 2009, developed countries agreed to help provide at least some of that money. Lauren Stewart at Oxfam says they bear most of the responsibility for creating the problem, and they also have the most resources to adapt, whereas
developing countries have done the least to contribute to the global climate crisis, and yet they have the fewest resources to respond and adapt.
With enough resources, they can respond and adapt.
A very powerful example is a solar park in Morocco. It's the largest one in the world.
Amar Bhattacharya is with the Center for Sustainable Development at the Brookings Institution. He says that solar park was developed in the last few years with hundreds of millions of dollars from the international community and multinational corporations. And it now provides clean energy to 2 million people in Morocco.
So it's a tremendous impact in terms of both a development outcome, but preventing, in some sense, that much emissions.
Bhattacharya says there need to be a lot more projects like it. But the reality is, the $100 billion a year pledge by developed countries is a drop in the bucket.
It was not based on any type of assessment of the needs.
Lorena Gonzalez works on climate finance at the World Resources Institute.
The $100 billion goal has been generally accepted as only a small fraction of the total investments that are needed.
The total annual amount of climate financing that developing countries actually need for mitigation, adaptation, and loss and damage is likely in the trillions. But so far, Erica Lennon at the Center for International Environmental Law says developed countries aren't even hitting the $100 billion target.
We're pretty far behind.
How far behind depends on who you ask and what they're counting. Even the most generous estimate from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in 2018 comes in at just under $80 billion. Lennon says the need to increase that number and raise the target is going to be front and center at COP26, the UN climate change conference that's set for November in Glasgow.
If we don't do something and do something urgently, the world is going to heat up
even faster and become, in many places, uninhabitable.
And the costs are only going to rise for everyone. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a very quick reminder that that economic truism that incentives matter is in fact true. United Airlines said today that better than 97% of its U.S.-based employees are now fully vaccinated. It also said it's going to start termination proceedings against its unvaccinated workers as soon as next Tuesday. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context. We began with Jay Powell. We will end with Jay Powell. He was asked today, the chairman was, about the congressional bickering over raising the debt limit and whether he has talked to lawmakers about it. And after saying that, of course, we got to raise it or bad things will this way come, he also said this.
You know, I don't generally ever talk about the conversations I have with elected officials or other appointed officials. But look, you can see that this is a major focus among those who have responsibility for it, and including elected people.
That's some Jay Powell shade right there, I'll tell you that. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Liana Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.